Hello, and welcome to episode 92 of the Decarceration Nation podcast, a podcast about radically reimagining America's criminal justice system. I'm Josh Ho. Among other things, I'm formerly incarcerated, freelance writer, criminal justice reform advocate, and the author of the book, Writing Your Own Best Story, Addiction and Living Hope. Today's episode is my interview with Leslie Sobel and Mika Weinstein of the Equal Justice Initiative about their new report on food in prison. Mika Weinstein has managed the Impact Justice Food in Prison Project since its inception in summer of 2018, overseeing the organization's effort to undertake the first national assessment of prison food. Mika graduated summa cum laude from the University of Oregon in 2014 with a degree in planning, public policy, and management. Leslie Sobel joined Impact Justice in the fall of 2018 as a research fellow for the Food in Prison Project. An educator and ethnographer, Leslie is the founder and artistic director of Story Soup, a project that creates contexts for dialogue across cultural and generational borders through food and narrative. She has over a decade of experience designing and facilitating cultural competency workshops to explore identity, systems of oppression, and intercultural and intergenerational communication. Leslie holds a BA in Gender Studies from Brown University and an MA in Cultural Sustainability from Goucher College. And we're here to discuss their report, Eating Behind Bars, Ending the Hidden Punishment of Food in Prison, which was put out by Impact Justice recently. Welcome to the Decarceration Nation podcast, Mika and Leslie.
Thank you so much, Josh. We're happy to be here.
Thank you.
I always ask the same first question. How did you get from where you started out in life, because it's kind of the origin question, to where you found yourselves writing a report on foods and food in prisons?
Sure.
Either one of you can start.
I can start. This is Mika talking. So I went to the University of Oregon, as you mentioned, and there's a program there. Have you heard of Inside Out, Josh?
Yes, I have, yeah.
So for listeners who may not be familiar, it's an educational program that brings university students into prisons to take classes with people who are incarcerated there. And as a freshman at the University of Oregon, I took an Inside Out class. It was a fantastic geography class. And it totally shifted, I think, the orientation of my career. Even then, I was interested in a number of different social justice issues, but there was something about spending time with, forming relationships with folks inside that really drove home this idea and point that our criminal legal system as it's set up now doesn't make sense. It's not helping create more safety in our society. And that sort of set my personal trajectory towards, you know, caring about changing the way that our criminal legal system works. I kind of simultaneous to that have always been interested in food and food justice. I think Leslie and I both share this. In some ways, my life revolves around food. I'm constantly thinking about what I'm going to eat next, the way that I show care for my friends is cooking for them, right? And so
I have no idea. I have no idea what you're talking about. Okay. I actually love. I kind of love food too.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. So it was natural that there was this interest in the nexus of these two issues. And on the Impact Justice side, I've been working with the organization for 3.5 years now, and I work. Most of my work is with a project that's focused on preventing sexual abuse and sexual harassment in confinement agencies. But the president of our organization, Alex, a few years ago noticed that there was a gap in the field in this area. So he knew that I had some background working with a food justice organization prior to Impact Justice and asked if I wanted to do some research to find out who's working on this issue, what's already being done. And not surprisingly, there was very little happening in that space already. And we decided that prior to trying to do some kind of intervention ourselves, it was important to really understand the landscape. And that was the impetus for us launching this study that turned into this very long report that you mentioned.
And what about you, Leslie?
So my path is a little different from Mika's. This is really my first foray into the justice reform space. I grew up in a family that's very obsessed with food, and food was the lens through which I learned how to see and understand the world. And I was always very involved with different food justice movements. And when I went to grad school, I chose to study culture through the lens of food. And I actually had a really interesting conversation during one of my grad school classes with someone who was doing a lot around decarceration and prison abolition. And I remember talking with her and saying, yeah, it would be really interesting to sometime look at, you know, how people interact with food in the prison space, you know, how they still communicate identity and communicate with other people through food. And then just sort of like tucked that away in the back of my mind. It wasn't anything that I ever thought that I'd get to at any point or even so quickly. Fast forward just a couple years, and I saw a posting on Idealist for a nonprofit organization that was looking to do a study of food in prisons. And I thought, huh, that's really interesting. You know, I'd be intrigued to see what would come of this and to look at not just the impacts of food on physical health, but also on mental health and emotional well-being, and how it impacts people's ability to interact with others, both in and outside of the prison setting, you know, how it impacts people's sense of human dignity, and really, you know, look at this from a different variety of angles. And so I sent in a cover letter, and Mika contacted me a few hours later, and here I am.
That's pretty cool. Just so people know, since both of you work there, what is, and either one of you can answer this one, what is Impact Justice?
Yeah, Impact Justice is a national research and innovation center. We are trying to create a justice system that is humane, restorative, and fair. So we have projects that focus on three different areas. We have projects that focus on diversion, so trying to prevent people from coming into contact with the justice system to begin with. We have projects that focus on conditions of confinement, so trying to improve the quality of lives for people who are currently incarcerated. And then we have projects that are focused on supporting successful reentry.
So you already kind of mentioned how the project got started, that you're the person who runs Impact Justice saw there was a hole in the in kind of the coverage. But is that how is that was that the genesis of this? What happened to cause the report?
Yeah. So like you said, Alex recognized that there was this gap. We hear from people who are incarcerated all the time about the various issues around conditions inside, and food is a common complaint. But a lot of the resources and attention, understandably so, focus on solitary confinement, on ending the death penalty, on trying to improve access to medical care. All of those issues do deserve attention, of course. But considering how profoundly the quality and quantity of food affects the everyday lives of people who are incarcerated, not just while they're incarcerated, but also after they leave, we, at least, of course, think that this issue merits a lot more attention than it's gotten in the past. And like I mentioned before, we wanted to make sure that any kind of future intervention project idea that we generated was really grounded in a deep understanding of how the system currently operates. And that's why we started with a research element of the project.
And Leslie, it sounds like both of you, from what I heard earlier, have kind of a background, at least an interest in food. How much did you all have to educate yourselves in things like, you know, nutritional requirements and needs, or public dietary health and things like that when you were getting started?
So we came in with a pretty decent knowledge of these things, I think partly just because Mika and I are both so deeply interested in food and have done work in food justice spaces. I'm not a registered dietitian, but at the same time, I do have many years of studying food from a cultural perspective, but also looking at the basic, you know, nutrition aspect of things. So I think, you know, a lot of those basics we already understood, but also I don't think, you know, that it takes a registered dietitian to be able to look at the issue of food in prison and to recognize that this isn't particularly healthy.
One of the things you all say in the report is that prisons are out of sight food deserts. And so, Mika, you know, I would say what happens in our prisons usually happens kind of in darkness, that they're kind of like by design black boxes. How were you able to penetrate the black box and kind of get the information in this very, you know, very detailed report?
We used a mixture of methods. I mean, my first instinct is actually that there's so much information that we still were not able to get access to. I agree that through literal years of effort, we were able to compile what I think is probably the most comprehensive reporting on prison food in America. But even then, you know, of course, we couldn't just walk into a facility on a given day without any sort of heads up and see what food was being served there. So, you know, we relied on the people who we considered the foremost experts, which are folks who have experienced incarceration themselves. We surveyed and talked to many people who have been incarcerated. And then we also used some connections and networks to talk directly with folks who work in corrections. And we were able to interview dozens of people who work in corrections. We were able to visit several facilities across the country, mostly in facilities where they're proud of what they're doing, right? A lot of folks in corrections take pride in the work that they're doing and want to be able to share that with people on the outside. And then I think a final element to this is that these are publicly run institutions. And so while we don't have the leeway or license to go in of our own accord, there is certain information that we are entitled to as citizens, as taxpayers, that we can leverage. And, you know, that's an area that I think when at the end, I'm sure we'll talk about how folks can get involved or what they can do, you know, asking for more transparency or information from these institutions that are publicly funded is something that folks can do.
And how completely were you able to investigate? Like, how many states were you able to cover? Kind of how good of a feel did you get for the national picture?
Yeah, so we had at least some information, even if it was just looking at the policies posted on their website about all 50 states. The level of detail and depth really varied. We did put out a survey through the Correctional Leadership Association that about 35 state correctional agencies responded to. Like I said, we interviewed folks in, I think, a dozen states. So we tried to have, you know, focus on geographic diversity. So we were not only getting answers from the same size states or same geographic areas. If you asked about a certain state, you know, the information we have may be limited, but I think that we covered enough ground that we were able to make some generalizations about the true crisis that is happening around food in prisons across the country.
Leslie, I know as a formerly incarcerated person that, you know, one of the things I worry about when I'm dealing directly with people who are still inside is putting them at risk. How did you all kind of deal with the kind of, you know, the questions of how to interact with folks inside and kind of protect them and stop them from, for instance, from retaliation and things like that?
We were very careful to, you know, make sure that we were protecting people's privacy. In the actual report itself, we don't identify any of the formerly incarcerated or incarcerated people we spoke with. We use pseudonyms. We don't identify the states in which we spoke to them. So it would be pretty hard to track down any of those people. You know, I think that was one of the things that was really at the top of our minds, was making sure that we were keeping the folks who were talking to us safe.
Your report starts with the following statement: a person sentenced to prison in the United States serves 3 years on average. That's more than 3,000 meals behind bars, far more for people serving longer sentences, all typically high in salt, sugar, and refined carbohydrates, and low in essential nutrients, a diet that for decades everyone else has been advised to avoid. I myself literally served 3 years, and so I guess I had those 3,000 meals. And I certainly agree with your assessment of the quality. I know our Department of Corrections would say that they have a nutritionist to approve the menus, but is that how seriously should we take that statement when they even would post things on the walls at the prison, I remember, that would kind of have the nutritional breakdowns? Where's the disconnect happening? What are we missing?
So I think there are a number of places where there's a disconnect there. First of all, we talked to a number of correctional dietitians, and several of them told us that although they technically approve the menus, they're basically putting a rubber stamp on the menus and saying, this particular menu meets the nutritional policies of this particular state. It doesn't mean that they actually personally approve of it as someone who has a professional nutrition background. So I think that's the first disconnect there. The second is that the dietitians look at the menus. They're not necessarily looking at the food that actually ends up being served, which, number one, could be completely different than what's on the menus because there's a huge gap between policy and practice. And number two, you know, food changes over time. So when food, you know, is cooked and heated and stored potentially for years at a time and then reheated and then potentially reheated again as it gets to a unit, if it's being transferred, the nutritional quality of that food can change. Certain vitamins and minerals decrease in amount and decrease in quality. So, you know, if the dietitians or the nutritionists who are looking at these menus aren't looking at the nutritional quality of the food that is necessarily actually being eaten.
And what you found, I think, you know, at least from my reading of it, is that a lot of people are not necessarily providing what actually ends up being nutritional foods. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. And, you know, I think some of it is that the food that's being served isn't particularly nutrient dense. There aren't a lot of fresh fruits and vegetables or high quality proteins. You know, there are a lot of carbs, a lot of what we would call empty calories. And so sometimes the nutritional aspect comes from these packets of a fortified beverage mix. They're kind of like a Kool-Aid or like a fruit flavored beverage that you add to water. And so that's where a lot of the nutrients, the technical nutrients, are coming from in prison food. And I think the other thing, you know, to point out is that a lot of the food that gets served on the prison tray isn't necessarily edible. And so people aren't getting those nutrients because they also aren't necessarily eating the food. So between not being able to actually stomach the food that's on the tray and being expected to get a lot of your nutrients from that fortified beverage packet, which a lot of people say they also don't drink because it tastes very chemically. And, you know, people talked about using it as hair dye rather than as an actual beverage. You know, the combination of that plus the concept that, you know, you shouldn't be getting all of your nutrition from supplements anyways. It's really best to have nutrient-dense food. All of that combined really makes this an unhealthy experience for people who are getting these meals.
You're bringing back, unfortunately, a lot of memories for me here. You know, I mean, I know in the work that I do that, you know, I get a lot of pushback, and many people ask things like, why should we care if people in prison get good food? You know, I have a lot of stock answers to this question, but what answer would each of you have to this question, this kind of notion that people deserve, you know, that prison is just desserts, no pun intended, and that, you know, if they get bad food, that's part of the punishment of prison?
So my response would be that I would like to think that for the most part, we have this shared goal in society of more safety, health, and well-being for everyone, right? And so we've been fed this argument for a long time that prison serves as a deterrent. Punishment serves as a deterrent for people to take part in criminal activity. That has been shown not to be true. Prison is not an effective deterrent. There are a lot of studies out there that show this. And so if what we really care about is promoting safety, punishing people isn't going to accomplish that, right? Harm begets more harm. And this issue affects more than just the people who are currently incarcerated. Millions of people cycle through our justice system every year. One in three adult Americans has a family member who has been incarcerated, and the vast majority, 95% of people who are in prison right now, are going to be released someday. So ultimately, you know, it is an issue of community health and well-being that people are taken care of, don't come out of prison with the kind of chronic health issues that we're seeing right now.
Leslie, did you have any thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I agree fully with everything Mika just said. And I think I would also add that food sends a message. We use food to communicate value and identity in relationships. And we're sending a message to and about incarcerated people through the food that we give them. And if we're providing them with food that tastes bad and food that doesn't promote health and well-being, and food that is sometimes literally labeled not fit for human consumption, then the message that we're sending is that these people are not worthy of care and that they're not fully human. And like Mika said, you know, 1 in 3 adult Americans has a loved one who's incarcerated. And there are, I think the statistic is over 5.7 million kids who have experienced the incarceration of a parent. And so sending people these messages that they're not worthy of care not only impacts them, but also impacts their family members, their children, and really impacts our society as a whole.
At one point in the report, you talk about kind of the history of correctional food provision. I don't know which one of you worked more on this part of the report, but what should people listening know about that kind of long history of correctional food provision?
Sure, I can speak to that question, Josh. There are a number of things that are coming into my head. I think one thing that it's really important to acknowledge right off the bat is that the history of prisons is closely tied up with the history of food production in this country, not just prison food, but food production on the whole, with ties back to slavery and convict leasing. So for people who aren't familiar, there was a practice that exploded after the Civil War called convict leasing that essentially was a way for plantation owners to continue to profit off of the exploited labor of mostly Black men. There was an incentive that was created for Black men to be arrested and incarcerated so that the state could sell their labor to private companies. And it wasn't just plantations or food production, but I think that was a big part of the labor that was happening through that system. And, you know, this meant that both private companies and the state were profiting off of this labor. There's a statistic that we share in the report. In 1898, almost 75% of Alabama's entire state annual revenue came from convict leasing. So this was like big business for the state as well. And some of the prison farms that operate today are on the same land that were former plantations. Convict leasing was outlawed in the early 20th century, but the 13th Amendment, which abolished slavery, did make an exception for people who are convicted of a crime, which is why you see people incarcerated now working in some states for no wages at all and some for, you know, 25 cents an hour. And it's really wild
and oddly enough, that amendment, the exception in the 13th Amendment was created as kind of a post-Civil War compromise, right?
Exactly. Yeah. So what we have is a situation where on the same piece of land, like, you know, the same few acres, right? You could look back 200 years ago, it may have been enslaved Black people who are working on that land and obviously not getting paid. And then 100 years ago, you know, Black men working on that land through convict leasing, not receiving wages. And then today, disproportionately, Black men working that same land for little or no wages as incarcerated men. I think that is really telling about the ways that white supremacy operates in our society and how systems transform to continue to accommodate the ways that we exploit labor, you know, thinking about the new Jim Crow and others who have observed the way that we continue to adapt our systems to exploit, you know, predominantly Black people in this country.
So 62%, and this really doesn't surprise me at all, having gone through it myself, 62% of the people you interviewed said they never got fresh vegetables, 54% said they never had access to fresh fruit. So what is the actual makeup? I know we talked about a little of this above with the drinks of most diets in our prison. Is there kind of a way to generalize it?
I would say that the diet is mostly carbs. We heard from most people that it was a variety of bread and pasta and biscuits and lots of yellow cake. And
there is a lot of yellow cake. That is very true.
That makes up really the bulk of the food that's on the tray. You know, from there, I guess it varies. You know, you might get a few slices of deli meat, some highly overcooked, overboiled canned vegetables, some canned fruit or fruit cocktail, things like that. You know, it does vary from facility to facility and state to state, but I think overall you can say that the food is carb heavy, it's high in sodium, it tends to be high in sugar, it's very bland, and there's often not enough of it. So yeah, I mean, it's not a healthy diet overall.
Yeah, and it's kind of weird. One of the things that we return to time and time again on this podcast is this notion of kind of short-term versus long-term budgeting. As I understand it from the breakdowns I've seen by Prison Policy Initiative and other folks, healthcare is one of the largest parts of prison budgets, but food is a much smaller portion of prison costs. Could spending more on money on food reduce the amount that prisons pay for healthcare?
Absolutely. Yeah, that's one of the arguments that we make in our report. You know, it's very difficult to do sort of academic research in prisons for good reasons because of the ways that unethical studies have been done in prisons in the past. But there are studies, even in the free world, that show that as an intervention for diabetes, for example, if you actually just pay for the food that people need to eat healthy meals, that can drastically reduce the healthcare costs. So both within and outside of prison, there's a lot of opportunity to actually take advantage of that relationship between food and health in a way that not only saves us money, but of course, promotes better health and allows people to live longer lives, the lives that they want to lead, doing the things that they want to do, that sort of thing.
And are there mental health implications and mental health care implications too?
I would say absolutely as well. You know, the way that our bodies interact with different nutrients, certain nutritional deficiencies can actually cause mental health problems, both on an individual level, things like depression, anxiety, things that are really within one's individual self, and also interpersonal issues. So there have been studies that have actually been done in correctional facilities that show that when nutritional deficiencies were resolved, that the levels of aggressive behavior or violent behavior actually dropped significantly. And so, you know, one would think, therefore, that by resolving those deficiencies, they would be able to spend less not only on medical care, but also on mental health care for folks who are struggling with things like depression or, things like aggressive and violent behavior that can also then be expensive for facilities to deal with when there are more incidences.
Yeah, there's also kind of an interesting subplot of this is that most violence in prison, it happens around debt, at least in my experience. And a lot of debt is related to food, which starts in hunger. Yeah. So there's, a lot of different parts of the causes of violence in prison that are probably related in some way to food.
Josh, can I just say about that? I think that's such an important point and something that, I want to take a moment to emphasize that, when we talk to folks in corrections, always their number one thing is safety and security, right? And food is so clearly to us a safety and security issue. 94% of the people who we surveyed said they couldn't get enough food to feel full. Over 70% said that they had to do things that were against policy or rules to get access to more food. So exactly what you said, right? Like we can see how violence and conflict is created out of a circumstance of deprivation that is related to food.
I mean, there's so many times where you'd see people, the people who are sneaking stuff back to the unit from working in the kitchen, would almost always have something, they were selling it at an exorbitant rate. And then so you get these cycles of people, trying to get more food. It's a vicious circle, literally, and very troubling. One of the things we keep returning to, obviously, we see, massively more deaths in prison because of COVID, massively more risk of catching COVID in prison. How have things changed in terms of food since the onset of COVID in our prisons? I can't imagine it's for the good.
No, it's definitely not for the good. I think the really bad food in prisons has gotten even worse during COVID. So in some states, meal times have been reduced to twice a day. In other states, people are only getting cold bagged meals like sandwiches and chips for all of their meals rather than hot meals. You know, we've heard from people that at the very beginning of COVID, people who were showing signs and symptoms of having COVID were being told to still report to work in the chow hall or in the kitchen so that those people were then potentially exposing everyone else to COVID. And at the same time, you know, once things got really bad, facilities went into lockdown, which meant that everyone was just locked in their cells all the time. And so people don't have the social aspect of food or eating food around other people, and are now contained in their cells eating these, you know, cold bagged meals all the time. So quality has really plummeted.
When I was incarcerated, this is one of my big frustrations. I've talked about this for a number of years. We had a horticulture program, but any vegetables grown had to be donated to local food banks. Could prisons be developing self-sustaining programs for delivering healthy foods kind of at a low cost to themselves?
So I think, you know, on the one hand, some of those gardening programs are really great, and they are opportunities for people to learn skills, to have access to fresh produce. On the other hand, like you said, you know, there are a number of those programs that don't actually allow the people who are working in those gardens to eat the food. So having a garden program doesn't necessarily mean that the food in the facility is going to improve. That being said, yeah, there are, you know, great benefits to having an on-site garden and getting fresh fruits and vegetables directly into the facility kitchen. And also there's the issue, you know, as Mika was talking about before, between having people who are incarcerated work the land for little or no wages at all. So it's really a balance trying to find, you know, what would be both fair in terms of providing compensation for people who are in those programs. And at the same time, you know, making sure that the gardens are productive enough to contribute to the meals of the facility, and also making sure that policy states that the food from those gardens would go directly into the facility kitchen.
I think you all mentioned that this something like this is happening at Mountain View Correctional in Charleston, Maine. Is that right? Or something close to this?
Yeah. So Mountain View has a very large garden. They grow all kinds of vegetables. They have kale, lettuce, you know, carrots, tomatoes, all sorts of beautiful gardens. And the food from those gardens goes directly into the facility kitchen during the growing season. And they also have an apple orchard that they rent from a nearby landowner. And the apple orchard has, I think, Mika, what is it, 17 or 18 different heirloom varieties. And so the folks who are learning how to tend the orchard are gaining really important skills to be able to work in the industry once they're released. So the food service manager at Mountain View is very dedicated. His name is Mark McBrien. He's an organic farmer himself. And he, you know, talks about how he believes food can be medicine or it can be poison. And he's very dedicated to getting those fresh fruits and vegetables directly in the facility kitchen.
So on the other end of things, you know, I think you mentioned several times earlier and also in the report about people reporting on food that's labeled not fit for human consumption. Is this a, you know, typical problem? Do you see this a lot? And what does it actually mean?
Yeah. So we've heard anecdotes about this from across the country. I don't think it's isolated incidents. I also, you know, it may not necessarily be the norm that if you walked into any random prison that that's what you would see, but we've heard it enough times from enough people that there's clearly a problem with this happening. In terms of what that means, there are a few examples that have come through in lawsuits. So there was a lawsuit in Oregon, for example, where I think it was fish bait that was being served to people who are incarcerated there. So it was not meant for human consumption in that sense. It was meant for fishing. We've also seen lawsuits that involved cattle feed. And we've gotten this question a number of times, like, how is it that this is legal? How does this happen? We agree, right? It seems unbelievable that this is a thing that could happen. But the truth of the matter is that in the few lawsuits that have been brought to bear trying to challenge the quality of food in prison as cruel and unusual punishment, the courts have very rarely sided with the folks who are trying to challenge the system. And so there isn't a legal precedent that I'm aware of that says that this practice is not okay.
Yeah, one thing I've learned over years of doing this work is that it's almost impossible to prove a cruel and unusual, an Eighth Amendment case. So, you know, if people know they can get away with something, then they're going to try to get away with whatever they can get away with, unfortunately. Another sort of side of this whole food thing is the food that is not provided by the institution in a sense, but is purchased. Your report also talks about items produced for commissary lists. And for anyone who doesn't know, people in prison can buy items from a pre-prepared list every week or couple of weeks. Did you all find that the food on these lists, and I think I know the answer to this question, was particularly healthy either?
So if your answer is that you think the food was not particularly healthy, then yes, you're correct.
Yeah, that was definitely the answer.
I mean, most of what's on a commissary.
It's a lot of salt.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's a lot of snack food, like chips and cookies and honey buns, soda. We also, you know, heard ramen noodles.
And ramen noodles is pretty much the king of incarcerated cooking,
exactly.
Basically.
So no, it's not really a healthy alternative. And the few times that there were healthier items, like there might occasionally be nuts or dried fruit, those things tend to be really expensive. And we learned from a lot of the formerly incarcerated people that we spoke to that most people can't necessarily afford those.
Yeah, oddly enough, some of the only positive memories I have of prison are kind of communal cooking around that stuff. People become experts in, you know, taking things that really should not go together and making really delicious food out of, what should be really terrible. Did you have anything more that you learned from kind of just this second kind of element of food in prisons and jails?
So, you know, I think you're absolutely right. People are very resilient and creative. And when given, you know, a lack of lemons, they will still figure out how to make lemonade. You know, I think that people are really inclined to look for ways to connect through food, to express identity through food, to feel a sense of comfort through food. And, you know, people will fight against the dehumanization and depersonalization in prison through food. And so absolutely, a lot of people spoke with us about how their most positive memories around food while incarcerated were what they made from the commissary, especially with friends. You know, if someone made a surprise birthday cake out of commissary cookies and pudding stolen from the kitchen, you know, and at the same time, that doesn't mean that those foods are actually contributing to long-term wellness.
And, you know, another element of this whole thing is kind of cleanliness around the kitchen and the facilities. What did you all learn about kind of prison kitchen facilities and food handling expectations?
Sure. So what we found is that the process for sanitation and safety inspections varies state to state. There's no federal guidelines, expectations, or oversight process. So there are some states where they partner with the Department of Health, for example, who has inspectors come in. Most commonly, we found that it is the state agency who inspects their own facilities. It would be the food administrator at the state level who would have staff that would inspect the kitchens at the facilities under their jurisdiction. But from the folks who have experienced incarceration, what we heard again many times was that the kitchen staff, I mean, the facility as a whole, always knew when the inspection was going to occur. And people would, who maybe wouldn't have otherwise gone to meals that day, would show up on the day that they knew the inspector was going to be there because they knew that there would be better portions, better quality food, right? And absent those inspections, we heard, I can't even count the number of stories that related to issues with sanitation and safety, whether it be mold, vermin, or other, you know, foreign objects in the food, just horrifying when you think about this being the only meals that you have access to.
And, you know, I would imagine that if I were trying to buy cheap food, one of the things I might do is try to get really cheap prices on stuff that's past its expiration date. I imagine most stores are willing to sell that at a much cheaper rate. Is it true or widespread that departments of corrections either buy and serve food that's past its expiration dates purposely or just keep food for such a long time that it gets past its expiration dates? Is that a common problem?
We definitely heard from people that they noted food that's past its expiration date in the kitchen. And I remember one correctional officer telling us that she would often have guys come up to her and say, look at this meat, the expiration date is 2 years past. So it is something that happens. You know, again, I don't think it happens in every facility, but it was certainly common enough that multiple people spoke about this with us. It's not anything that correctional agency leaders have talked about. So I think this is one of those things
I can't imagine that
it's hard to get more information about exactly how common this is.
And what about people who have like food allergies or diabetes or a need for a special diet? What do you all find out about that?
So there are formal processes through which folks can request special diets. The number and type of special diets varies state to state. So commonly there are special diets that are focused on health reasons. Like you said, maybe someone has an allergy or has diabetes. And then there are other special diets that are specific to someone's religious observance. And again, this process is not uniform, but we heard many stories from folks who have been incarcerated that it can be a lot of bureaucratic red tape to try to get access to these diets. There is someone who we talked to who is allergic to beans, and the process to get, he had to go through, I think, multiple tests to actually show that he was allergic to beans. And throughout that time, he still had to eat the mainline fare. And when he finally got a replacement approved, it was pasta instead of another protein. That's just one example. We feature others in the report. But while the special diets do exist, it's not always an easy process to get access to the food that people need.
And what about the use of food as a disciplinary measure? I certainly remember when I was incarcerated, whenever anyone was sent to solitary, they would get what was called loaf, which is kind of some bizarre compression of food from that or everyone else would get. What did you kind of learn about food as a disciplinary measure?
So interestingly, one of the things that most correctional leaders would tell us is that we don't use food as a disciplinary measure. Food should never be used as a disciplinary measure. And at the same time, we heard so many stories from people who, like you, also received the loaf or Nutri-Loaf, there are a number of names for it, while they were in solitary confinement. And we heard,
and let me tell you, it's as special as it sounds.
Sure, yeah. And we've heard so many stories from people about other ways that food would be used as punishment as well, from something as simple as, you know, the officer saw you trading a food item in the chow hall, so now you both have to throw away your trays, or, you know, an officer might smash your commissary stash because, you know, of something, some random reason. You know, there are even stories of,
oh yeah, that definitely happens. Yeah,
yeah,
absolutely.
You know, and there are stories of things like, I think it was in an Alabama prison where the warden, you know, said that people whose hairstyles weren't in compliance with the codes were not going to get their meals or were going to be, you know, fed disciplinary meals. Or so there are definitely ways in which food is used as a disciplinary measure, as a punishment, even when officials say that it's not.
And then we also have, you know, kind of the design element of eating, you know, that, you know, generally when people eat together, it's social space, you know, it can be something that, you know, is very a way to share significant, you know, experience with each other. You know, food is a social experience, I think, for most of us outside. Are there problems kind of with the design of chow halls?
Yes, and I think for a number of reasons. Like you brought up the social aspect of it, and that's definitely a big one. We had people telling us that it's really stressful in the chow hall because it's so loud and crowded, and you don't necessarily get to choose who you're sitting with. So the person sitting next to you could be your enemy. You know, that social aspect of it can be taken away. And at the same time, there's also the literal physical environment of the chow hall. So as humans, we respond to different physical cues. Our physical environment really matters. Things like light and sound and smell can cue physiological and psychological responses inside our bodies. And those can be either positive or negative. And, you know, if you think about it, if you're at home and you're trying to have a romantic dinner with your partner, maybe you dim the lights, you put on some music, you cook something that smells good, you know, so we're aware of this way of using these cues, even if we're not actually thinking about it. But in a prison chow hall, you know, there's fluorescent lighting. There often aren't windows in the chow hall. There's, you know, it's very loud. It's all concrete. There are metal bolted down tables with stools rather than tables and chairs. You know, people wait in line and they wait in line and then they finally go up to a window where the food might be handed out just by a pair of hands through a slot. It's very, you know, it's very dehumanizing. It's very stressful. You've got, you know, people shouting, or you might have corrections officers yelling at you to hurry up. And so all of this put together can cause disruption in the body. It can actually make people experience a fight or flight response, which can then, you know, make people put them in a mindset where they might misinterpret social cues as hostility, which again makes the environment less safe for everyone involved. So yeah, I mean, the light and the sound, all of these things impact the ways that our body absorbs and digests food. Alongside the social aspect and, you know, just the expectations that when we eat food, it's a social experience. It's something that we share with other people.
You know, one of the things people always bring up is private prisons. And I always say that private prisons affect about 8% of incarcerated people, but prison privatization affects 100% of people incarcerated. Michigan's experience with food privatization was so bad that even the correctional officers joined the fight that ultimately ended the practice here. What did you all learn kind of about food privatization?
Yeah, so there are a number of states, even if they don't operate fully private prisons, they'll privatize elements of incarceration. And one of those is food service. We heard, so we did hear from someone who had worked in corrections that one of the benefits of privatized food service is that the contract requires more monitoring. And so there, you know, then maybe you would see in just a normal state operated system. And so from that perspective, you might get better compliance. What we heard generally, though, across the board was that privatized food did tend to be worse. You had there's no incentive for, I mean, there's little incentive for anyone who's working in correctional food service to make sure that the folks who are incarcerated there actually enjoy the food, right? It's not a customer service relationship. but at least
I laugh to stop from crying.
when the food is privatized, it's even a further degree removed where they're being paid per meal, regardless of whether people show up, whether people eat the food or like the food. There's really no incentive for them to cook meals that people are going to enjoy eating. And again, because they're a corporation, their concern is the bottom line. They're going to cut corners wherever they can. And that leads to an overall degradation in the quality of food, which is what we, you know, heard for the most part from folks who had experienced privatized food service.
So this brings us to kind of like, I was going to ask a large number of questions about this, but I think it'd be better just to ask a two-part question. Maybe both of you all could take a stab at it. You know, what should we be doing differently? And how do we get to where we're doing something different? Because as you mentioned before, you know, it's nearly impossible to win an eighth, you know, a cruel and unusual punishment case. And there's not a lot of incentive for departments of corrections to change if they're not going to be forced to change. So what should we do and how do we get to where we're doing something different?
That's an excellent question.
I don't know if you actually have an answer.
So, you know, in terms of what should we be doing differently, I think the first thing is we need to, you know, re-examine the standards of what is acceptable in terms of prison food. We have this, you know, this sense of, oh, prison food is bad and that's okay. It's supposed to be bad. And we need to stop thinking like that and shift the narrative that people who are incarcerated only deserve bad food, and actually think about ways that, you know, people should be eating that promote health and well-being, you know, and really try to work towards that. So I think, you know, what would that look like? We would have food that's actually food and, you know, that's a good place to start, right? Fresh fruits and vegetables, high quality protein, you know, food that people would want to eat on the outside, food that tastes good and smells good. And, you know, and also be able to use food as a way of trying to help people heal. So, you know, giving people an opportunity to have meals with their families on visitation days, or, you know, if kids are coming to visit their parents in prison, you know, how about some sort of cooking class that they can take together? You know, there are so many ways that I think food could be used to help strengthen relationships and to put people into a better mindset. And we're just not taking advantage of those opportunities right now. And there's certainly plenty more I could say, but Mika, I'll hand it over to you to give this one a go.
Sure. Yeah, I would echo what Leslie said. And, you know, a few other things come to mind for me. There's changes that can be made on many different levels, right? There are things that an individual facility food service manager can do that is currently within their power to change the quality of the food that they're serving. There is policy that we can advocate that, you know, to change so that, like Leslie said, the standards and guidelines are different. There's also, I think, a really important piece of the puzzle, which is that we incarcerate too many people. And that's not something that leaders of departments of correction have control over. They don't get to decide how many people are convicted and sent to them. So they are, you know, not everything is sort of under their control. But as a society, we've adhered to this, you know, very sort of tough on crime narrative and sent people to prison, but we aren't willing to foot bill to actually provide the, you know, basic human rights and a decent standard of living for people who are incarcerated. My opinion, obviously, is that rather than, you know, funding departments of correction to a greater extent, that we drastically reduce the number of people who are incarcerated now. If we cut the prison population in half, it would be a lot easier to afford better quality food for the folks who are there, right? That's something that, you know, there's not one specific action necessarily that, you know, I can say that everyone should take, but as a society, trying to move in a direction where we're actually shrinking the size of our prison systems and the number of people who are under correctional control.
Yeah, I think that both of you would have to admit, and I think to some extent Leslie's answer encompassed this, is that, you know, it's a lot of this is a political question. And, you know, we've been facing, you know, 5 decades of what I would call, you know, Willie Horton politics. Do you have any ideas for how we can move the politics of this, which is, you know, really where this has to happen if it's, you know, causing more decarceration, you know, hence the name of the podcast, or just ensuring that people get better food? You know, do you have any thoughts on just kind of the creating the political will to make these changes?
Well, I think that's part of the purpose of our report. Everyone understands food, even if they don't have the language for it. You know, Leslie talked about this. We use food to communicate values and relationships. And one of our hopes in releasing this report was that giving people a window into how terrible the experience of eating in prison is will help generate some understanding and compassion for the fact that people who are incarcerated are people. You can put yourself in their shoes. If you can imagine, you know, not having control over what you eat every day. I mean, that sounds like a nightmare, frankly, to me, let alone all the other horrors of incarceration. And so anything that we can do to uplift the voices of folks who have been incarcerated, to tear down the walls, the black box, as you mentioned earlier, to expose people to the conditions of incarceration, I think is helpful in the process of humanizing those folks and hopefully pushing the kind of overall narrative towards, like, is this really what we want to be spending our communal resources on?
Leslie, did you have any thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I, you know, agree with everything Mika said. And I think to piggyback on that, I think we also need to work on raising awareness of the depth of the impact of food. I think, you know, like Mika said, we're all very aware of food on this visceral level. Like, it, we all have feelings about it, and we all have food experiences. And whether you're, you know, a food obsessed person, like I think the three of us are, or not, food, you know, really resonates with a lot of people and tells you a lot about someone, the way that they eat. But some of the deeper impacts, you know, looking at the relationship between food and trauma, or the relationship between nutrition and substance use, or, you know, like we were talking about, the physical eating environment and health, like all of these things are really deep, profound impacts that I don't think most people are aware of.
This year, I'm asking people if there are any criminal justice related books they might recommend to others. Do you all have any favorites?
Yeah, I'll give a shout out to a book called Through the Wire, written by Lashana Thompson L, who's a friend of mine. It's a memoir of her experience growing up in DC in a really violent circumstance. And then she ended up being incarcerated for, I think, 19 years. And she is now the co-director of the Cure the Violence program that's run through the Office of the Attorney General in DC. That's a violence interruption program that is focused on de-escalation and preventing conflicts before they turn into violence. She's amazing, and her memoir and story are amazing. And I'd love for more people to read about it.
Leslie?
I will recommend What We Know, Solutions from Our Experiences in the Justice System by Vivian Nixon and Daryl Atkinson. That book, I think, holds a special meaning for those of us working at Impact Justice, because our wonderful colleague Tara Lawyer has a chapter in there, and she is the leader of the Homecoming Project at Impact Justice, which is a program that provides housing, shared housing spaces in people's homes. It's kind of like an Airbnb style situation for returning citizens.
So if people are looking for your report, where can they find it?
They can find it on our website, which is impactjustice.org. It's right on the homepage right now. or you can Google Eating Behind Bars, and I'm sure it will pop up.
I always ask the same last question. What did I mess up? What question should I have asked but did not?
I think you asked great questions, Josh. We got to cover a lot of material. Of course, in our, you know, 130-page report, there's a lot of detail that we didn't get to talk about. And so I would encourage folks to go find the report and read it, or read sections of it. And I would just like to end, you know, personally, on the thought that this is a problem we can do something about. There are so many issues in our society that feel intractable, complicated, like we don't know how to solve it, but people have been working on improving food in K through 12 schools, like put a lot of resources and time and effort into doing that. So, and there are models in other countries we can look at. Like, we know that it is possible to change the quality and quantity of food in prison to a place that's acceptable. And to me, that feels like something that we can do.
You have anything to add, Leslie?
Yeah, I would just add that this is an issue that, again, touches so many people and really touches so many different movements for justice. So it's, you know, an issue of conditions in justice work. It's a food justice issue. It's a racial justice issue. It's a labor rights issue. It's an environmental sustainability issue. No matter what you're working on right now, please try and consider how the issue of food in prison fits into your work and fits onto your agenda for change, because it really touches so many people.
This was a really enjoyable conversation. I learned a lot. Thanks so much for doing this. I really appreciate the time.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Josh.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
And now, my take. In many ways, my effective activism started with an organized Twitter protest against federal correctional officers complaining in the press about holiday meals for incarcerated people. One of the very first episodes of this podcast nearly 4 years ago was discussing problems with prison food, and yet, here we still are discussing this same problem. A large percentage of violence in prison revolves around food. Food is the primary currency in prison, and debt is often paid off in food items. People without funds in their store accounts also covet and extort people who do have funds in their store accounts. At least some of this violence is attributable directly to the fact that prison food is god-awful terrible. It's not filling, it's not nutritious, and it usually is beyond disgusting to taste and to eat. As a result, too often, competition over the more often more filling, more costly, and equally unhealthy food for purchase from the store list often becomes physical and sometimes even deadly. In addition, one of the largest costs in prison budgets is healthcare. Prisons may not have to provide great health care, but they do have to provide health care, and poor nutrition leads to bad health and worse health outcomes, which is one of the largest drivers of prison costs. All of this happens even though food is one of the smallest and not one of the largest budgetary costs, and the means exist in almost every prison to grow fruits and vegetables through prison horticulture programs. As Bruce Western mentioned during last week's podcast, so many of the problems in our prisons start with the societal dehumanization of people in prison by people outside of prisons. Way too often, people outside of prison refuse to consider people in prison as human beings. We have to start valuing people who happen to be in prison as human beings if we want any of this to change. Maybe, and I'm just suggesting, you know, just throwing this out there, we could start by ensuring that incarcerated people get healthy, nutritious, and filling food to eat. As always, you can find the show notes or leave us a comment at decarcerationnation.com. If you want to support the podcast directly, you can do so from patreon.com/decarcerationnation. For those of you who prefer a one-time donation, you can now go to our website and give a one-time donation. Thanks to all of you who have joined us from Patreon or given a donation. You can also support us in other non-monetary ways by leaving a 5-star review on iTunes, or just like us or follow us on Stitcher or Spotify. Special thanks to Andrew Stein, who does the editing and post-production for me, Anne Espo for helping out with our transcripts and our Instagram and Facebook images, and to Alex Mayu, who helps with our website. Make sure and add us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook, and please share our posts across your network. Also, thanks to my employer, Safe and Just Michigan, for helping to support the Decarceration Nation podcast. Thanks so much for listening to the Decarceration Nation podcast. See you next time.